All rise. The State of Washington Court of Appeals, Division 1, is now in session. Honorable Michael Stern is presiding.
Be seated, everyone. Good morning. All right, our first case, in re the parentage of KBM. Council ready to proceed.
I'd like 4 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Very well.
Good morning. May it please the court. Patricia Novotny on behalf of Suzanne Marsh, and also on behalf of this 9-year-old boy, if not technically, at least emotionally, a child whose extreme distress the trial court acknowledged but then failed to remedy, leaving in place too much of a parenting plan that brought us to this crisis.
Ms. Novotny, may I just ask a clarifying question?
Yes, please, Your Honor.
I think really will shape the direction that the parties might want to argue, but it's unclear to me from the court's order. She signed three orders here, but the one I'm talking about is the one in which she signed the parenting plan. Were the, I'll call them conditions rather than limitations, because limitations invokes 191. I'm not trying to do that. Is it your position that the conditions that she did finally impose here on the father, those fall under 191 as limitations? Or are you taking the position that this is a minor modification? Because it really matters in terms of the rest of what she did here.
Well, correct me if I don't understand your question correctly.
Well,
but here,
if you don't understand, and I want to see if I can.
To clarify, my client petitioned for major modification, alleging detriment and not,
minor.
And I don't recall that, but. But certainly adjustments to dispute resolution and those kind of non-residential things as well, and alleging 191 bases for limitations on residential schedule and otherwise. So from our perspective, we went into trial, and it was tried as a major modification that the parenting plan that was in place needed to be substantially changed, and that, yes, there were bases for 191 restrictions, and that the limitations here the court ordered, you know, whatever she called them, they are of the same character as the court might impose under 191.
Okay, so let me make sure I understand you. You're saying the conditions that the court imposed on the father, continued alcohol treatment, mental health, et cetera,
right,
are all conditions that trigger 191. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, it's a little backwards. For example,
it may be, but because it matters. It matters because once you say the court actually imposed conditions, whatever she labeled them, minor. In this case, she said this is a minor modification.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that?
Is it really, given the actual conditions that she imposed? Because
I see what you mean. Yes.
In 191. That's a whole different statutory framework from which other provisions restrict the type of conditions the court can impose. For example, decision making. If we view these conditions as falling under 191, 187 statute seems to say that the court cannot impose any dispute resolution other than court. There are a lot of other provisions that matter as to whether it's 191 or not.
Yeah,
and that's why I'm asking you to tell me what you think it is or what you're advocating.
I'll tell you what I think it should be and what is implied.
That's not my question.
Well, I don't know what it is because I don't think the court makes it clear.
And that is, can you make the findings, whether they're written or not, necessary to support the conditions the court imposed without also necessarily making the findings that trigger the implications of 191?
I don't really have a good answer for that. Under Cabo Quinto, for example, we see that the court has broad discretion to order various kinds of limitations or requirements of parents, right? And this, I've gone around and around with the Supreme Court on this precise issue. And then subsequently, we have 191 that seems to establish as a predicate that the court must make some findings under that statute before it can impose these kind of limitations. I don't know where the kinds of limitations that the court can impose without 191 authority stops and where those other kind of pre-existing and the more common ones like no disparaging comments and here's what you're going to do with telephone contact and things like that, regulatory requirements that the court commonly imposes without 191, I don't know where that exact marker is.
Where do you think it should be?
Well, I think if you're going to require people to go to treatment, that you should be required to make a finding of some factual basis for the treatment. That's not the kind of, you know, again, regulatory common restriction on parents. But rather, I think that if it was my client or me and the court was saying, you got to go get some treatment, you got to go learn some things, you know, there's a lot that I want you to do related to your personal health and your mental well-being, here's why. I'm finding that you have these sorts of problems. And then look to the statute. So I think...
Well, I think that one of the fundamental problems, as I view it, and I can only speak for myself, is, and you can respond when you come back, but the core problem here is we don't know what she did, because we don't have any findings. And normally we would be here saying, okay, challenging substantial evidence, and that evidence doesn't support the conclusion. But your briefs make it sound like summary judgment briefs, frankly. They're arguing each side's best facts. And
well,
to me, speaks loudly about whether or not there are sufficient findings here for us to even review. So I'll do it from
Yeah, just before I lose my thought here, I'll take 30 seconds and just say that it's. I think that findings clearly are inadequate for review, but I think they are the inadequacy of the findings is symptomatic of the more serious defect, which is the court's failure to engage with the evidence that was presented at trial. And so I do think that's where the substantial evidence dovetails to an extent with this, is that the court, you know, introduced its own views about mental health and expert matters that, you know, are not appropriate. The court can't take things that it's heard at drug court and contradict an expert. And so I think there is this, and it cannot imagine that a man with these kinds of problems can suddenly just kind of get better over the course of the trial. So I think there is a much more serious defect than just not knowing what the court did. To the extent we see what the court accomplished, the evidence does not support this order. So just before I lose that thought I wanted, but otherwise I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. You'll have 3 minutes on your clock.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Shelby Lemel of Masters Law Group on behalf of the respondent, Kevin Whitson. Judge Lemel, let me first turn to your question immediately and see if I can address both the question about the conditions and then about the adequacy of the findings. First, what the trial court did, of course, is enter conditions, conditions that are consistent with what my client had already done for, at this point, almost 6 years, and at the time of trial, 5 years, which was to treat his bipolar disorder.
So is this a minor or major modification?
It's a minor modification. Now, the court could have entered 191s and chose not to. And the reason is that my client had been successfully treating for 5 years.
When you say the court could have, do you mean the evidence would have supported
191? No, that she was asked to, and that was an issue before the court that clearly she chose not to enter. And under an abuse of discretion standard, had she, that perhaps would have been a defensible position. But she didn't enter 191s. And to do that, what you would be saying is not, it's of course not enough that my client has a mental health problem. What you have to find to enter 191s that were being proposed to the trial court was that those mental health issues are a significant impairment on his ability to parent the child. Well, those mental health issues had been treated for 5 years successfully. Even the parenting evaluator acknowledges that there's no evidence in the record that he hasn't been compliant with his medications, that he's consumed alcohol since he was diagnosed bipolar and been treated for bipolar, or that he is currently in treatment for his Asperger's syndrome, which the court addresses and says, not only do I think you need that treatment, but you want it, and you're actively participating in it.
Not a single finding mm-hmm. orally, and I really have questions about whether she even attempted to make any findings since she entered this order in chambers, but she made not a single finding as to the only expert, and that is Carson. She mm-hmm. didn't say, I don't believe you. She didn't parse through and say, this part I have trouble with. She said nothing. I know that the father had retained a rebuttal parenting evaluator and chose not to present that testimony, relying solely on the evidence that was provided through Carson. But isn't that a problem?
No.
At least with regard to the absence of findings, why not?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of answers to that, and one is that parenting evaluators and GALs are not treated the same as other experts before the court, and that's been discussed in Newsstand v. Fernando, for example. That
did she even consider Carson's testimony at all?
Well, there
can
would
you tell from the findings?
I would never assume that the court doesn't consider the coroner.
Did she make any findings as to any of Carson's opinions?
No, she did not, nor is she required to under the Supreme Court's decision in Horner, which directs this court under a far more difficult 9-point statutory inquiry in a relocation proceeding, that findings are not required, so long as this court can see that the trial court has articulated the rationale for its decision. This court comes out of
the
bench.
Where do we look for the rationale? What articulates why the trial court chose to ignore the evaluator or disagree with the evaluator?
Because she comes out on the bench and tells the parties, what I see here is a kid who needs to participate in some sports. And he needs the there's 2 weekends a month here. And she's saying, let's give him some time to participate in sports, because that's positive.
And how does that inform us as the Supreme Court says we must be about the thought process of the trial court?
Because she goes on to say that his life in White Salmon is what she refers to as idyllic. The time spent with the father and his parents in that situation is positive. All of that is a rejection of the notion presented by the parenting evaluator that the father is the cause of the child's distress. I mean, in acknowledging that the residential time with the father is positive and that the time with his grandparents is positive, you're rejecting the premise being put forward that the sole cause of the child's distress.
Did the trial court make a finding of what the cause of the extreme distress was
for
the child?
No. No. And in asking this,
in the absence of knowing what the cause was for the extreme distress, how can we make any sort of judgment about whether any of the restrictions imposed or other conditions of this this order are appropriate? How can we make that judgment?
This court doesn't generally require a trial court to enter negative findings, and it sounds to me that that's what opposing counsel is asking the trial court to do, is explain.
Did the judge make any findings?
No, she did not make findings. She came on the bench and gave the reasons for her decision. And the reasons for her decision is both lives this child has is positive. His time in White Salmon is positive, and his time in the Seattle area is positive.
You know, the difficulty with that is it puts you all in the briefing in the position of arguing to us what the facts are that the judge relied on in coming up with these reasons for deciding the case as she did. We're not in a position to judge those facts, and without the judge making those findings, it seems to me we're at somewhat of a loss of how to go forward.
Well, typically what this court does in that scenario is look at the record and look at what the court said and determine whether its decision is justifiable.
The record is fairly conflicting, you would agree, I would imagine.
I don't think it's conflicted at all in terms of what the court said about the evidence, and I think there's copious back and forth between the judge and the witnesses, and then she comes out on the bench and says, here's the parenting plan I would like to see, and I want you two to put it together, bring it to me, because that's probably going to be a better result for you than if I do it myself.
That counsel is relying on and calling a finding. It was very evident from the transcript here that the trial court was trying to get you to settle.
Yes.
And to induce the parties to settle, she says, I'm going to tell you where I'm headed.
Mm-hmm.
Those are not findings. That's counsel. Yep. I want to give you a hint about where I'm going with this. and I want you to try to settle. And 20 minutes later, when the parties couldn't settle, she made some comments even before closing that parties are relying on as findings. I mean, there are many, many cases in which we have said that in certain types of cases, we can look at the court's oral findings. These are not even oral findings, though.
Your Honor, there are many cases in which this court says, including the Supreme Court in Horner, that findings, oral or otherwise, are not required when the court gives a basis for its decision.
It doesn't CR 52 say findings are required?
Yes, and the Supreme Court has said otherwise in the context of issues like this. If you can see the basis of the trial court's decision. Now, I agree with you. If you can't, if you don't look at this record and you don't think you can see what the trial court was trying to accomplish here, then you have to reverse and remand. But you remand for the entry of findings consistent with the court's decision or otherwise.
If you agree we can't look at the adequate cause determination made by the court commissioner? The court commissioner had some very, very strong language about what she was concerned about, and that's why she granted adequate cause for a full-on hearing, mm-hmm. one of which is the child's bowel problems. We still don't know what, from an expert's opinion, what is causing this child to have bowel problems. I think everyone assumes that there's a cause and effect, but no scientist would ever say cause and effect based on, gee, he's with dad, he has the problem. When he's not with dad, he doesn't have the problem. That's not science.
So if I understand you correctly, you would require expert medical testimony on this issue.
I'm not requiring anything because I can't figure out what the trial court relied on. She didn't mention really much about the issues upon which adequate cause was granted.
She says adequate cause is granted because of the encropesis, for one, and because of the distress that the child is experiencing in school, which is directly correlated to the litigation between these parties.
You know, that's the commissioner speaking. That doesn't tell us what was going on in the thought processes of the trial court judge, a separate person, does it?
No, I believe the judge made the same adequate cause determination, Your Honor. Perhaps I'm incorrect about that. I don't think adequate cause is being challenged here.
No, I agree it's not, but there's an argument made in the briefing that we should look to the court commissioner's decision to inform ourselves as to what was the rationale for the decision, and we're taking exception to that because that's not the fact finding.
That argument was simply responsive to the argument that there aren't findings that are addressing the only issues that are before any trial court in a modification, which is adequate cause and best interest of the child. No, plainly adequate cause is documented on the record. So the question is, can you tell whether the court...
We would only look to the commissioner's decision to decide whether or not there should have been a full hearing once mm-hmm. the full hearing takes place. And we're satisfied that what party was entitled to it. We don't do anything further with the commissioner's findings.
No, the issue then is whether the best interests of the child were adequately considered by the trial court in modifying the parenting plan. You know, let me just briefly, in the couple seconds I have left, because it appears that the court is unsatisfied with the record that the trial court made. You have been asked to enter extraordinary relief here and effectively vacate the trial court's decision, and I of course ask that you not do so. That would require you to reweigh all of the evidence before the trial court. If there's not adequate findings, remand it to the trial court and give her a chance to fix the record. Thank you.
We would like remand for the trial court to fix the problem, not just the record. And this child doesn't wish he was dead because of a long drive or because he can't play sports when he wants to. He has a serious problem. And the trial court failed to even really understand that or accept that. And I understand you don't want to make findings, but I think that to send it back just for findings to fix the order so that the order can somehow stand fails this child with consequences that I think are terrifying.
Aren't you asking us to do something we don't do, and that is to weigh the evidence without the benefit of having heard the witnesses testify?
I'm not asking you to do that because I know your answer, but I'm asking you to remand with instructions for the trial court that go beyond simply enter findings to support your order. I think the trial court needs to be...
What else would you suggest that we should be telling the trial judge that doesn't require us to form a judgment as to what the evidence establishes?
Well, I'm not going to... I think you go too far in what you can't do. Look at Stell. I mean, the court there was able in Stell to see that the trial court was not... You know, again, ideally, we'd like to go back for a new trial in front of a trial judge. As a realistic matter, my client's tapped out. She's up to her eyeballs in debt. Right? I don't know how that can happen, but I think the trial court here needs to focus on the problem that was presented and the evidence that was presented and not on some wishful thinking, not focus on the grandparents. The grandparent relationship is fine, but it's the parents' relationship that's at issue. It's the father's condition. It's the medical evidence, the not only the psychologist, but the medical records she relied on in making her recommendations about what this father needs to be, you know, not an obstacle to parenting of this child.
Is Ms. Marsh's trial counsel request a presentation hearing of any kind or an opportunity to argue the factual findings with the court?
I don't remember. I think the trial court was headed out of town on vacation, and I think it just, I don't remember exactly. Right. Yeah, I can't recall that particular question. But I do want to urge on the court to, again, revisit Stell, because I think this case is so much like that. Also, I did provide some supplemental authority about borrowing evidence from other cases and how the court really can't introduce that kind of evidence. And I did want to say, again, with the remedy, I think you have to go beyond just fixing the findings. That's not the problem here. It's the child that needs... Finally, I just want to say the minor and major modification issue is very intriguing to me, and I didn't go into a lot of detail in the briefing on that, and it's come up in other cases. And if the court would accept additional briefing, and if I can provide some useful, I would like permission to do that. Not now, but
on the existing record, it's up to the trial court to decide which it is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel.